You're tuning in to another episode of What Do I Know with me, Joe MP. And can I tell you something? Today I'm wearing this floral shirt that is the most floral of all the shirts I've ever worn for all the seasons of my podcast. Yes, that's right. If you're listening to the audio version of this, know that there's a video version available on YouTube, so you can head over and check it out. But before you do that, let me dive straight into today's episode. My guest today is Remy Chu, who is a lawyer, and in my opinion, he's got this career crafted out for him, well, when he was in his teens. He was a member of his school's debating team, and he actually made his first public speech about democracy and civic participation at Hong Lim Park's Speaker's Corner when he was just 15 years old to a group of 80 retirees. I tell you, there's fire in this man, and it's no surprise that he got global recognition for his work in human rights litigation. He was the first Singaporean to be awarded by the International Bar Association for Outstanding Young Lawyer of the Year Award. Now that's something. Most recently, he made a rousing speech at Pink Dot about the repeal of 377A. Hi, Remy.
Hey.
Hi, Joanne. Catch you off guard a little bit there.
I was expecting it.
I wanted to also give a little bit of context here that since your speech at Pink Dot this year, PM has already announced in August that this 377A will be repealed.
Yep.
And of course, we know that you've been actively campaigning, if I may be allowed to use the word.
Yeah, sure.
Campaigning for the LGBTQ community. And what you did was you actually acted for members, right? In two constitutional challenges against Section 377A of the Penal Code between 2013 and 2022.
Mm.
Right. So as how we always begin, we kind of have to have a little bit of context of what... I know you've probably answered this many times, but what 377A is and, you know, why is it such a big deal for so many people here?
Okay, so 377A in short is a law that was left to us by the British in 1938 when Singapore was still part of the Straits Settlements.
Mm.
In a nutshell, it is a law that prohibits same-sex sexual conduct between consenting men. Doesn't matter how old you are. So adult men who engage in what is called acts of gross indecency will be in breach of 377A.
Mm. Right. Which means it makes them criminals.
It makes the sexual act criminal, but obviously gay men engage in gay sex, so it effectively criminalizes a section of the population.
Mm, okay. So why is there so much about this 377A that is being discussed and, you know, there's this for and against argument?
Right. So it is probably the only piece of legislation that singles out a particular community for criminalization, right? Or put another way, the ultimate act of expressing love that a lot of us take for granted and see as natural, that is the act of consummating your love in the sexual act, in the context of gay men, because of 377A, that is illegal, right? So that's a problem because it brands a section of Singaporeans criminals in the eyes of the law.
I think this is something that maybe some people might not be able to understand, or maybe because it doesn't really relate to them. How can we help people understand why it's such a big deal?
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really great question. And actually, you'll be surprised. Some of the people who ask these questions are in the gay community too. So in the course of my work, gay people have asked me, look, 377A is not being actively enforced. The government said they're not going to actively enforce it. Do you think this is the right time to rock the boat? Why are we bringing this issue up? Why are we making such a big deal about it? Isn't it making society more divided to highlight this flashpoint, right? My explanation is quite simple. Whether or not it's enforced, it sends a very powerful negative message when the state says in the law that it is okay to discriminate. It is state-sanctioned discrimination. It is state-sanctioned criminalization. And what that means is it shapes the way gay people see themselves. And it also shapes how we perceive our place in the community. It also reinforces the suggestion that the very nature of who we are is something that is shameful, is something that is abnormal, is something that is not accepted. And while 377A is still there, that's the message it continues to send. The message is the state agrees. It's the law. Right.
Right, right.
And you know, Singaporeans, we're very law-abiding.
Well, before I want to ask you how you feel about the repeal, I guess we talk a little bit about, I mean, what were some of the arguments for and against this repeal?
So, the Singapore Constitution is what I call the law of laws. So, it's like the daddy and mommy law. It's like the alpha law, right? It's the most powerful law from which all other laws need to be in conformity to. And to the extent that it any law is not in conformity with the Constitution, it can be struck down.
Okay.
So, what provisions does the Constitution have? It has provisions that protect our freedom of speech, right? It has provisions that protect our freedom of religion, right? So, if you want to profess and propagate your Christian faith, for instance, you can do so because it's constitutionally protected and the state can't stop you from doing that, okay? There is one provision in the Constitution that protects equality before the law. So that's the Equal Protection Clause, called Article 12. And it guarantees the right of every citizen equal protection of the law. And when you look at that, and you look at 377A, there's this big red flag that goes up because this is a law that, on the face of it, it discriminates. It's so obvious, right? It's so intuitive. So that was the legal argument in 2013. In 2018, when the challenges were brought again, until the cases were finally decided earlier this year, right? That it is a breach of the Equal Protection Clause. The arguments in support of keeping 377A, I would say they are much more emotional rather than legal arguments. They are arguments largely from protecting society and the family from moral corruption. Those are the types of arguments we heard to try and convince the government to retain 377A. And they are arguments from people who fear the way Singaporean society could evolve towards if 377A was repealed, right?
How do you feel about that, those arguments?
Well,
is there ground for it or is there a counter-argument against that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I may be a bit biased.
Sure, sure. You know, it's all about presenting our perspective here. And like we said, you know, it doesn't mean that we are right. You know, it's just a different perspective.
Yeah. So, I mean, I grew up in Methodist school. I went to ACS. And I'm like a full-on ACS boy. So like primary school, secondary school. I went to Barker, then Independent, so I've actually been to two ACS secondary schools and ACJC. And if you go to ACS and you're an ACS junior, if you want to go on a play date with your friends, that naturally involves going to church and then going for a play date.
Oh, right.
I also used to be a practicing Christian. I grew up in the church, with the church, and with the Bible. And in a very religious community. And so I can understand how a lot of people of faith feel about the way the world is changing and the fear when they look at what they see as the depravity of Western society. Okay, so I understand where that sentiment is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but as a gay man, my lived reality, who I love, how I love, how I grew up, and the years I spent having to hide because I was afraid, all that is a lived experience.
Mm.
It is who I am. Mm. It is how I love. Mm. It is how I relate to my community and my family.
Mm.
I can understand if there is some neuroses about how society may eventually look, but to me, discrimination, that's not acceptable because it affects the way I live my life.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Then there's also the argument that how, well, if we repeal the law, then it makes it okay. Like, it's saying that you're making it okay and therefore you are like normalizing it. So then impressionable youths may get influenced and think it's okay. And there's this part of the argument as well.
Uh-huh.
What is your take on that?
And yeah, that's great because being gay is okay. And it should be understood and affirmed because that's who people are. And the alternative to that is reinforcing sense of shame, reinforcing a sense of having to hide who you actually are instead of living in a society where you have a range of options for people to be their best selves, right?
Mm-hmm.
And choose to discover themselves in an unfettered way.
Would you say that it's that you're born gay, or is it?
I think so.
Is it because you know this argument is put forth in a way that suggests that if you're straight, that you might become gay.
Okay.
But what I'm hearing from you sounds very much like this is just you are born like that.
Okay,
this is
so I speak for myself.
Yes, yes.
And actually, there are a lot of there's a lot of literature on the fluidity of sexuality, and these days even gender. Right.
Mm.
My lived experience is, I think, I was born more gay, lah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not so much about influencing youths to become gay, but rather, you know, for when you make it okay in that sense, when you repeal the law, you just letting all these people who feel that they have to hide have the courage to come out.
That's right. And you're also helping them see portrayals of the full spectrum of the complexity of human existence, right?
Mm.
Because there really isn't any benefit in not letting them see the full range of human experience,
yeah.
Right?
Mm.
And from blocking them from seeing people who might be like themselves, right? And unfortunately, because of 377A, a lot of portrayals in the media and society of gay people have been quite negative.
So there is also a law that states that, I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, that states that you're not supposed to portray homosexuality positively in the media?
So there are IMDA film classification ratings and free-to-air media guidelines and classification ratings that allow the IMDA to either ban or put age ratings on content that is deemed to be against public morality or acceptable social standards. So recently, Buzz Lightyear, the cartoon,
yes,
it got an NC-16 rating because there was a gay kiss and a character that was in a normal and loving a relationship, even though it was a very short segment. Right. So it's not actually even about positive media portrayals of gay people. It's just pretty regular and normal portrayals of gay people as people not having any particular issues or living in committed and stable relationships. These types of portrayals will attract either age ratings or bans.
Right? Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Does this repeal now then makes it okay?
Not necessarily. So we don't know yet. So the law, we don't know if that's going to change. So one of my favorite movies is this Japanese film called Of Law and Love. It's a film about a gay couple in Osaka and their lawyers. So they run their own law firm. And the law firm they run, it does human rights cases. So actually, the film isn't about them being gay. It's about them and the cases they do. So they do cases for conscientious objectors that don't want to sing the national anthem, for instance. Free speech cases. They do freedom of assembly cases. They do freedom of religion cases. And because the film was about a gay couple, it attracted, I think, R21 or M18 rating. I thought that was a bit ironic because one of the really nice and kind of poignant scenes in the film is this couple at a high school doing anti-bullying and anti-discrimination talks for the children, right? So it's very wholesome. And it's a great film, but if you were to watch it in Singapore when it's screened in 2018, you wouldn't be able to watch it unless you were over 21.
I see. So then how do you feel now that the law has been repealed? We got what we wish for. We've been fighting so many years for this and, you know, sigh of relief.
Yeah, so there's a sense of relief, right? But it's definitely not any sort of like triumphalism, like we're there now. Something I say repeatedly is, you know, discrimination against gay people, the LGBTQ community, it didn't start with 377A. It's not going to end with 377A. Okay, so 377A made it or gave a lot of people and a lot of institutions, a lot of organizations who wanted to discriminate the excuse to discriminate, right? But those instincts and those kind of dynamics, they're not going to change overnight just because of one law, just because 377 is taken away, right? It's not going to overnight change bullying in schools. It's not going to change education policy in respect of gender non-conforming youths. It is going to take quite a long time before we get to where I think we need to be in terms of positive media portrayals. And that's not even to start talking about things like equal housing policy. And I mean, all the rest of it, that's potentially quite a long way off.
But these are also the things that people are concerned about protecting, isn't it? The policies that you're talking about.
Public policy is public policy. It's policy that's supposed to be made for each and every Singaporean and not just for a particular group of Singaporeans at the exclusion of others, right? And that applies not just to gay people, but it also applies, for instance, to singles who want to get public housing but cannot because they're not married, right? They want BTO, right? These types of laws, policies and regulations, I think they're problematic. So not just for gay people, but any aspect of public policy where there is active discrimination against a group of people, I think really needs to be very thoroughly thought out or thought through. Right?
But you can't please everyone, isn't it?
You can't.
I guess it's like, what do you think can be done then? Like, because you know, if you do this, one segment is going to be unhappy, and then if you don't do this, the other segment is going to be, So how do you think we can get there?
Yeah, so, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with just visibility.
Mm.
I think one, representation and visibility, it's so important. So, you know, media representation is very important, not just for gay people who want to see ourselves portrayed as regular members of society, right? But also for people who are afraid, or parents who might be afraid that their children are gay, right? Mm. For them to see and to understand one, that's entirely possible, and two, if that does happen, it's quite okay. I think that's important. It's important to let Singaporeans understand that we are here. We're probably your relatives. We're probably your friends. We're your loved ones. And we have people we love too. We have families who affirm us or want to be in families that affirm us. There's no reason to take things away from us.
But it does sound challenging considering that Singapore is quite a religious country, isn't it? We have many different religions here. And like you said, you know, when you have a faith,
yeah,
that can be one of the reasons why it's hard to accept that, you know, my family member or my loved one is gay.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's kind of important to split up what our personal religious beliefs might be versus what public policy should do or how the state should make laws, right? I think even the most conservative or the most religious people I know would feel uncomfortable suggesting that the government should make laws based on religious feeling, right? Because if it did, then we wouldn't have, for instance, casinos, right? The point of public policy making is making policy for the public good. And the best interest as well as the values of Singaporean society, right? One of those values is inclusion, diversity. It is also about meritocracy, right? Discrimination cuts against these values, okay? So I think that it's a process of educating or just convincing people of faith that giving gay people space does not mean taking something away from who they are, how they worship, how they believe, or what they believe, right? So one of my best friends, back in 2007, when the issue of 377A was first being debated in Parliament, he was not sure whether or not he was for repeal. He wasn't. So he thought, look, the church's teaching is that it's immoral. It shouldn't be condoned. This law is consistent with what the church teaches, and therefore I shouldn't. It's something that should stay on the statute books, right? And over time and over many debates and many discussions with him, he slowly came round to seeing that what he personally believes does not need to or is not any less just because it's not hardwired into legislation. Right. what happened between then and now is he's now a civil servant. So he understands how public policy needs to be made, right? Mm. And that you do things or laws should be made for the greater good. Mm.
Yeah. You have been so open about you being gay.
Mm.
And I would like to invite you to share a little bit about that. Like, you know, coming out and the struggles that you had before you came out and what was that like?
Yeah, so I came out pretty late. When I was 30, I'm 36 now. So I tell people it's funny that I did the two sets of 3778 challenges, one in 2013 and one in 2018. I wasn't out the first time I fronted the challenges as one of the lawyers. And in 2018, I was. What happened between then was pretty painful, actually. It's actually like I still kind of cringe when I think about how I came out, right? I was on holiday with my first boyfriend. It was 2016, I think. We were in Siem Reap, and I got a call from my aunt. So just by way of background, my mum passed away some years back, and so my aunt was almost like a surrogate mother to me growing up. My aunt calls me when I'm in Cambodia, and she asks me, who are you, where are you now? I said, well, yeah, I'm on holiday. And she said, have you seen this website? And I asked her, what website? And apparently what had happened was someone who didn't like the work I was doing, I think it was my human rights work, had started a website about me being gay and somehow managed to get a photo of me kissing a guy outside a gay bar and had put that on a website and just to make sure that everyone I knew about it too. He or she had printed out hard copies of the website and mailed it to my house.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
I would be freaked out.
I was terrified. I was really, really scared. And so the next thing my aunt asked me was, who are you with? And I said, I'm with my boyfriend. And she didn't say anything for one. She said, why girls not good enough? And so I think it's kind of like her way of telling me is, you know, like, relax, right? And what happened after that was I came back to Singapore. It's around December. And the next time I went over for family dinner, she said, invite your boyfriend over for Christmas. And I just heaved this big sigh of relief, right? Because for so many years, I was so afraid of this part of me that I now realized I shouldn't have felt like I needed to hide.
Mm.
And so I brought my boyfriend over at Christmas and you know, my family was very accepting and made him feel very comfortable, made him feel like a part of the family. And it really made me regret all those years I'd spent running away from sharing this part of me with the people I was the closest to, right? But that's what shame does, right? That's what discrimination does. And that's what happens when discrimination is hardwired into society. You have people in the community that don't feel safe coming out. Or like me, get outed. Right.
But also, there could also be consequences to your loved ones.
Right, exactly.
Because, you know, it's how, you know, if your parents are, you know, they might be, they have friends they have to answer to. Like, you know, your child is gay.
Yeah, yeah.
And especially because you're so prominent as well. and high profile in the work that you do.
Yeah.
So that's also that, that part of it that makes it very difficult.
Very difficult, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, being gay, you're always coming out, you know? The coming out never ends, right? And when you come out, sometimes your family has to come out too.
Did they ever have to sort of deal with any backlash from this? You know, you were outed so publicly. Like, what were some of the things that they had to face?
I think they were just kind of scared also. Like, just everyone was really, really on edge.
Because it's very intrusive, you know?
Extremely.
So, like, to mail.
Extremely, yeah. To mail it to.
Means I know where you
that's
live.
That's right, I know where you
I
live.
I know who,
exactly.
who your loved ones are. Yeah. And, oh my goodness, this is.
Yeah. 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 And after that, I went to the police.
I'm standing.
Yeah. I went to the police. We tried to find out who did it. But the person who did it used the VPN that routed back to Vietnam.
Wow.
So we never found out. In a way, I was lucky, open, close inverted commas, that had happened. Because maybe if not for that, I might still not have had the courage to come out. And fortunately or unfortunately, it happened at a point in my life when I was independent enough to bear the consequences of that being outed, right? Even if it had gone badly. And I was very privileged, I was very fortunate that it did not.
Yeah. And I think it also took your aunt a lot of courage to be able to sort of look at it in the eye and said, you know, I am going to accept it.
Yeah.
So what was that, how it was like growing up for you? That, I mean, did you think that they sort of have always knew, but then they just sort of not encourage, but not by not discouraging is like encouraging, you know, that kind of way? Was it like that?
In Asian societies, there are certain things we just don't really talk about, right? And I mean, sex is one of them, you know. Who you date, until a lot later on in life, you just don't share these things with your loved ones, with your family, right?
Yep.
So it's kind of, I don't know, like, it just wasn't something we talked about, you know. And even till today, like, even now, my sexuality, that's not something I feel very natural communicating about, but I do it because I think it's important. You know, I do it because I think I've got enough independence. I can deal with the backlash, right? I can take the blows. And I think it's important for other gay people who may not be able to see that there are people who are okay talking about it and okay talking about themselves, even if it's a bit
uncomfortable. So
you
are in a way serving as a role model for the others, right? In that sense. I think it is, because I mean, I hear you talk just now from the start. You've just been going, us, we, you know, in our community. You are so open about the fact that you are representing your own community in the work that you do. So that's why I think, while it's something maybe you will not be very comfortable sharing very in-depth or very publicly about it, but I thank you for giving your trust in me and this platform to share this story, because our intent is also to be able to provide perspectives.
Yeah.
And some of us, we don't, I mean, I can be honest, I have got gay friends, but we don't have that starting point to start talking about this, you know, like, how do you feel about this? What are the challenges that you face? And it's just not something you discuss over dinner even, right?
Exactly.
So I do feel quite privileged to be able to hear your side of the story and to understand, because what we see often is just on the face value. We don't know what goes on behind. And I remembered in our pre-call, you did ask me a question.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, which was...
What was one of the misconceptions you had about gay people?
Yeah.
And how did that change and why did that change?
I am also very honest because I cannot tell you where I got this impression from, but I think it always tend to be associated with promiscuity and perversion.
Uh-huh.
There's always a little bit of that, the misconception that gay people are very promiscuous.
Yeah.
They have no loyalty to one partner and that they are predators.
Right. Of
young boys.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So like,
I'm so sorry. I mean, I hope I don't offend anyone. These are just the misconceptions that I used to have.
Yeah.
Very frankly.
Yeah.
And it was only until after I got to have gay friends.
Yeah.
I mean, coming into the industry, obviously, opened up my social circle and I got to know gay friends. And I've seen, you know, some of them have very stable relationships, very healthy, very stable relationships. Mm. And some of them are together much longer than some married couples, heterosexual couples have been.
Yeah.
And then I realize, well, actually, love is love.
Yeah.
Then you understand what it is. It's not just about the sex.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not physical. It's not a physical thing. But I guess the misconception used to be that it's a very physical thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, two of my best friends, one of them is in his mid-70s. The other one is in his late-60s. They've been together for 20 years. One is Swiss, one is Singaporean. They met in Washington, D.C. And when I hang out with them, what always strikes me about these long, committed relationships that has endured over the decades before repeal in 2022, before civil unions in Europe, what really strikes me is this is a love that's endured despite, you know, despite societal disapproval, despite very difficult social circumstances.
Mm.
To me, that's really powerful, right? Mm. And the second thing that I thought of when you were telling me what you did about, you know, these impressions that we start off with. And that's how I thought about it too growing up, you know, that it was a perversion, that there was something very wrong about it. A lot of this comes from the media we consume, right? And the media that we consume, it trickles down into these perceptions that we have.
So it could also be the media that our parents consume and then they sort of and tell things, you and all that.
Yeah. So, okay. There's this walking tour that a friend of mine does.
Mm-hmm.
It's a gay walking tour. It's a historical gay walking tour. And one of the pieces of memorabilia he has is a new paper article from 1992 that has four different types, an illustration of four different types of gay perverts, okay? So I'll just read them out to you. The first type of gay pervert is the voyeur. The second one is called the teaser. The third one is called the cruiser. And the fourth one is called the exhibitionist.
As in the flasher, is it?
The flasher, yeah. And one of them talks about grooming young children too. So these are illustrations in a national newspaper, granted quite some time ago, 1992. Mm. But those are the kinds of media portrayals that were commonplace for a lot of gay men growing up in the 90s, in the 2000s. And it's really only a lot more recently that we started even seeing mentions of homosexuality or committed gay relationships in the print press, okay? Let alone media.
Mm. There's a saying that you hear, oh, now there are more and more gay people.
Actually, we've always been there.
Well, I would think that it's also that, and also because there was no media, like this social media and all this right. different media
yeah.
before. So it's always a contention, like whether it's always been there and now it's just because of media and it's made possible for us to hear more about it. Or is it because, oh, media, there's a lot of influence, so therefore people are more bold about, you know, going that way. Like, you know, there's always this both sides of the argument.
I mean, you know, the discrimination gay people face, LGBTQ community face, it's quite tangible. The bullying, the negativity, and just the very casual exclusions, you know. Like, you hear the government talk about pro-family policies and how the repeal of 377A does not mean we are going to stop promoting the family. And that sounds quite normal on the surface, but if you're a gay person, you'll be thinking, hey, I've got a family too, right? Mm. Why is removing discrimination against me somehow supposed to be linked to anything that may potentially be anti-family? I struggle to see a situation in which someone would say, I want to be gay because it's cool. That's not the way it kind of works. So people who say that, ask them, look, be realistic, right? Let's baseline here. Like, what rights do we not have? Okay. It's not particularly fun. So to suggest that, I'm going to see gay people living normally and I'm going to therefore become gay. That's as plausible as me watching decades of Channel 8. I'm still not straight.
I see your point. It's very, very eye-opening. I mean, actually, also to hear from you, because it is a perspective that I think, unless we are in it ourselves, we won't understand. And I guess also, I have got this question posed to me before about, you know, what if your children were to be gay? How would you respond and how would you react to that? Yeah. I think my husband and I, we also did talk about this. And I think we are lucky in that sense because we are more informed right now about what it is, right? Yeah. And how we can communicate with our children about it.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, my children at this age, my 7-year-old, she's already asking me questions like, can a woman and a woman get married? Mm. You know, would you have another boyfriend if you don't have papa? You know, I mean, these are very complex questions, at least from the adult's point of view. I mean, from the child's point of view, it could just be a very innocent, simple question.
Yeah.
But for us, I mean, I would never be able to get into their headspace to know why they're asking what they're asking and what is the intent. So, they are curious.
Yeah.
And I think my husband did ask my daughter, so like, do you like boys or do you like girls? And she says she likes both boys and girls, which is very natural at this age. And I do think that it's normal, right? Because they're not quite thinking that yet. It's just really everybody is a friend.
Yeah.
But soon, you know, she will get there. And I want to think that we would love our children regardless of their orientation. And like, after hearing from you, and I guess, you know, you do have a point, which is, you know, it's how can it be a choice when the odds are stacked against you?
The odds are stacked. It's, I mean, a lot of gay love is love despite, you know. And, you know, this question about how parents feel if their children tell them that they're gay, right? I mean, there's one group of people, and I'd like to think they're actually a bit of a minority, who would feel unhappy because they inherently hate gay people, or they've been brought up to just think it's a perversion, right? But there are a lot of parents who would feel or who express that they feel concerned because of the challenges that children might face growing up.
Mm.
Because the reality is society discriminates.
Mm.
And parents want the best for their children.
Mm.
So in that type of situation, my prescription or my suggestion for parents who find themselves in that situation where their children tell them they're gay and they are genuinely concerned for their child's well-being would be to ask the question, what kind of society do I want my children to grow up in?
Mm.
Right? How can I advocate for them to be treated more equally, to be more completely accepted?
Mm.
And of course, that comes from the base case that we can choose our friends, but we can't choose our family. We love our family and we want the best for them. And if we do, we accept them for who they are.
Mm.
Right?
Mm. I mean, hearing what you shared, the repeal of 3778 doesn't mean your work has ended, obviously.
No, yeah.
What else is, you know, are you going to be fighting for with this? I mean, one thing out of the way, but there's still a lot of work left to be done.
Yeah, you know, I see myself as a... I saw someone say this in a TED Talk. He said, I see myself as a matchstick. And once I've been struck and the torch has been lit, it is for the next generation to carry. Right?
See, I'm right. I said there's fire in this man. I saw it. Okay, yes, please.
And I think an important part of advocacy or activism has to be to make yourself irrelevant, right? Mm. To move the societal needle such that the problem that you've been trying to confront is no longer seen as a problem.
Mm.
So from the 2007 parliamentary debates to the 2013 challenges, the 2018 challenges, what's happened in between is thousands of people turn up every year from 2019 to Pink Dot, right? There are dozens of community groups that are working on trans rights, on community health and well-being, sexual health, and we've come to a point, fortunately, where the movement for repeal can now go into the sense of history, right?
Mm.
But I think the next chapter of queer activism, of Singapore's journey, that's going to be written by, I think, younger, more woke people who didn't grow up with the baggage, fears and limitations that people like me had to struggle with.
Mm.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Do you feel on the ground that it's a little bit different?
Oh, like totally. Yeah, totally. I mean, younger activists, people on Twitter, they have what I call different imaginative horizon.
Mm,
a different imaginative horizon. When I was in university in 2007, when the debates were happening, the main person who was anti-repeal was also my constitutional law professor, Professor Teo Lien. And back in the day, some of the things that were said in Parliament about gay people were extremely, extremely hurtful. And it was difficult to imagine in 2007 that we might see repeal in our lifetime, right? So my struggle and my imaginative horizon and the causes that I fought for, in a sense, were kind of time-bound, you know?
Mm.
The parameters, my imaginative horizon was repeal. But people who didn't grow up with that baggage, who grew up attending Pink Dot as kids, what they can imagine society can become is so much more unfettered than what I can or what I think might be possible, right? And I think the future belongs to them. Yeah.
Since you talk about Pink Dot, maybe, you know, tell us a little bit about Pink Dot just for the listeners. And what is Pink Dot? What does it do? And is there a need for Pink Dot?
Okay. So, I'm not in the Pink Dot committee, just so you know. So I don't speak for Pink Dot. But Pink Dot was started in 2009. The reason it's called Pink Dot is pink is the color of an IC. So Pink Dot, I think first and foremost, is about standing up for belonging, right? A sense of place in society. It's also Pink Dot because the color you get when you blend red and white. So red and white are the colors of our national flag. If you blend that, it's pink. Over the years, every year in Pink Dot, there are different themes. So like in 2014, the theme was family and friends. And so Pink Dot, to me personally, has always been about turning up, showing up, being visible, and creating a safe space for gay people and our allies from different generations to just be together, right? And it's so important because in so many aspects of our lives, we are either invisible by necessity or invisible by choice. So Pink Dot's that time when all of us get together and we're seen. We see each other and we're seen, right? So that's why I think it's important. I think it's still important. And it's played a huge role in just letting Singaporeans know that gay people are just like them.
Do you think that that could be or would be or maybe it might evolve into something else, be a bridge for people who do not really understand the LGBTQ community to understand them better, to coexist more harmoniously?
It's fun. So a lot of my friends bring their family, bring their friends. This friend I was telling you about who still is very religious, I think he started coming to Pink Dot in 2014. He's straight, married, and that's very important for not just his understanding but also to his friends who are gay, who know that he's there not just to understand but to support, right? And it sends a very strong signal.
So when you are you made a rousing speech this year at Pink Dot, and then you're so forward about advocating for this, you must have also had a lot of backlash.
Yeah,
I mean, other than
the stalking,
the letter incident. Yeah. Was there any other time you felt threatened or discouraged or maybe I should just shut up and not do this? Like, why do I you don't need to, actually. But then, you did it. So was there something that triggered or ever triggered you to want to stop advocating?
It happens. It happens actually very regularly. Like every time before I do press or every time before I do interviews, I always ask myself, is it necessary for it to be me, right? Or do I think I'm the best person for this? Can someone else do it? Would someone else be better representation, either to a different part of the community or a different ethnicity? Like, why should I be the one doing it? And then secondarily, there's always the concern about the trolls lah. And sometimes after the press clips go out, you will see the comments. Some of it will be negative.
Mm.
And yeah, it does get to me. It does.
Then how do you overcome it?
When
it gets to you. But then you see it gets to you, and then you agree to come on my podcast and do this. Like you would agree to do it again.
Yeah, because I think it's important, like I said, to be seen, right? And to hold space, right?
Mm.
If I could deal with being stalked and being outed, there are a lot of other people who deal with a lot of worse things. And so I think it's important to be there and be visible and to communicate not just to the community, the LGBTQ community, but to people who may not share my point of view, right? To people who might, in the best of faith, have a very different perspective from me. Because I'd like to believe that they're open to being convinced. Right?
Just to wrap up our conversation, you know, how do you think, you know, people who are pro-LGBTQ and people who are holding traditional family values can agree to disagree respectfully?
Yeah, so like I think it's really important to just listen and to understand and dialogue and to just start from the premise that as far as possible, the person you're dialoguing with who might have a different view, they hold that view genuinely, right? Putting aside trolls on the internet, right? But if you're having a face-to-face conversation with someone and they hold a different view from you, assume that that view is being held in good faith, right?
Mm.
So the one thing I ask those who are kind of so-called anti-LGBTQ to consider when speaking to their gay friends about what it's like to be gay, think about or consider where some of the hurt and anger might be coming from, right? Some of the reactions you get that might be strong. It's because comments about the LGBTQ community and our rights and lifestyles, our choices and our options. These are questions that are fundamentally about who we are and how we love. So if the response is passionate, if it is at times a bit angry, understand where that's coming from. Yeah.
The way I look at it, it's really identifying what is that fear in us. So if we are to, what is that fear that is stopping us from including this community, you know? And is that fear real? Because a lot of it could be, like we talked about, it could be biases from negative portrayals in the media. It could just be based on a lot of hearsay.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really being able to understand where that is coming from. Well, to wrap this up, I do think that if we are thinking about moving forward with a more inclusive society, that we need to really be able to understand what being inclusive means. Because a lot of times we talk about, oh, we want to be inclusive, but then maybe our actions are actually shutting certain groups of people out. So there's a lot to work on, and I think a lot for us to think about too.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and any parting shots for us?
If something I really wanted to say, it would be that we're here, right? Gay people, we are around you. We don't wear signs on our heads, or we don't wear the rainbow flag. So you may not know we're there, but when you say things that, or when people say things that are hurtful about gay people, just be aware that we're probably there. We're probably your nephews, your nieces, your uncles, your aunts, your siblings, or your children. And things you say will matter to us, right? Especially those of us who are not as comfortable as I am being visible, right? And words have power. So use that power wisely, lah.
I really do want to thank you for being here today and to allow me to have this conversation with you, because I could ask all these questions that I probably wouldn't be able to ask without sounding weird, you know, and I feel that I've really gotten a glimpse of what it's like on your end. I mean, I will not declare that I know for sure, because I don't and I won't, but at least, you know, I understand from your point of view some of the struggles that you had to face. And, you know, what, how discriminated are you, is your community facing? And what are the discrimination that your community is facing? So I really want to thank you for your time and for agreeing to do this. So thank you so much, Remy, for being here.
It's been fun.
Thank you. This episode was brought to you with a lot of love. So please give us a 5-star review and remember to follow so you don't miss a single episode. A video version of this podcast is also available on YouTube, so remember to check it out for some bonus content. I'm Joanne Pei, and I'll see you in the next episode. Bye! Bye. That one. Bye!
This was the Zodapop podcast.